wife kept wrapping the scarf around my head, telling me to keep my head down, to not peer above the truck's sides.
The soldiers walked around the neighborhood, knocking on all the doors, telling people to leave. Those who refused were shot dead right on their doorsteps.
Pa shakes his head. Why are they doing this, Pa? Keem asks.
Because they are destroyers of things.
Chu and Keem look at each other, and I sit there, feeling lost and afraid. I don't understand. What does all this mean? I ask them. They look at me but say nothing. Yesterday, I was playing hopscotch with my friends. Today, we are running from soldiers with guns. After a quick lunch of rice with salted fish, we climb in the truck and move again. I watch as a stream of people seems to follow our trail. Fighting drowsiness caused by the smothering heat, my thoughts race from one subject to another. I question why we had to leave, where we are going, and when we will return home. I do not understand what is happening and long to go back home. The sudden sputtering and choking of our truck halt my daydreaming. It kicks and whines, and finally stop. I climb off, hoping it will move again.
The truck's out of petrol, and there's no petrol station around here,
Pa says.
Looks like we have to walk the rest of the way. Everybody grab only some clothes and all the food you can carry. We have a long way to go yet.
Pa then orders us what to take and what to leave behind.
You!
Someone yells. We all stop what we are doing and stand, paralyzed.
You!
A Khmer Rouge soldier comes over to us.
Give me your watches. Certainly.
With shoulders bent to show submission, Pa takes the watches off of Meng and Koi's wrists. Pa does not look the soldier in the eyes as he hands the watches over.
All right, now move,
the soldier orders, and then walks away. When he is out of earshot, Pa whispers that from now on, we are to give the soldiers anything they want, or they will shoot us. We walk from the break of day until the dark of the evening. When night comes, we rest by the roadside near a temple. We unpack the dried fish and rice and eat in silence. Gone is the air of mystery and excitement. Now, I am simply afraid. 7 day walk. April 1975. The first sight I see when I open up my eyes the next morning is the glum upside-down face of Chu against the background of cloudy skies as she tugs at my hair. Wake up. We have to move again, she tells me. Slowly, I sit up and rub the seeds out of my sleepy eyes. All around me, a sea of people wake. Babies cry, old people groan, pots and pans clang against the sides of wagons whose wheels grind the dirt beneath them. There are many more people than the numbers I know to count them with. My eyes follow Koi and Meng as they walk into the temple with big silver pots to fetch water. Cave says there is always a well near a temple. Moments later, Koi and Meng return visibly shaken with their empty pots. We went into the temple but found no monks there, only a Khmer Rouge soldier, they tell Pa. They yelled for us to stay away from the temple well. We stopped and came back, but other people went in anyway. Koi's words are interrupted by the sound of gunshots coming from inside the temple. Hurriedly, we pack our belongings and leave the area. Later on, we hear the Khmer Rouge soldiers had killed 2 people inside the temple and wounded many more. Today, our 3rd day on the road, I walk with a little more bounce in my step. In Phnom Penh, the soldiers had said we could return home after 3 days. The soldiers told us we had to leave because the United States was going to bomb our city. But I have not seen any planes in the sky and have heard no bombs dropped. It is strange to me that they made us leave just so we can turn back and go home after 3 days. I smile at the silly picture of us marching like black ants coming to a stop at the end of the day only to head back home. I do not understand, but I guess 3 days is how long it takes for them to clean the city. Pa, will we go home soon? The soldiers said we can return home after 3 days. I tug at Pa's pants. It is afternoon, and we are not even slowing down yet.
Maybe. But meanwhile, we have to walk.
But, Pa, this is the third day. Are we going to turn around and walk back home now?
No. We have to keep walking,
Pa says sadly. Reluctantly, I do what Pa tells me. Everybody has to carry something, so I pick the smallest item in the pile, the rice pot. As I walk, the pot becomes heavier and heavier in my hands as the sun climbs higher and higher in the sky. The metal handle digs and burns the palms of my hands. Sometimes I carry it with two hands in front of me. Other times I switch the pot from my right to my left arm. But it seems no matter how I carry it, the pot painfully bangs into some part of my leg. It is evening now, and I am losing hope that we can go home tonight. Tired and hungry, I drag my feet, taking smaller and smaller steps until I am far behind everyone else. "Pa, I'm very hungry and my feet hurt," I yell to him.
"You can't eat now. We have very little food left, and we need to ration it because we have a long way to go."
"I don't know why we have to save it." I stand still in the road, letting go of the rice pot to wipe dirt and tears from my cheeks. "Our 3 days will soon be over. We can return home. Let's just go home. I want to go home." The words somehow come out between halting sobs. My 40-pound body refuses to walk anymore. The red dust from the road and the sweat on my body has mixed to create a layer of mud on my skin, making it dry and itchy. Paul walks over to Cave and takes a ball of sticky rice out of the pot she is carrying. He comes over to me and hands me the food. My eyes look down at the ground in shame, but I take the food from him anyway. Silently, he strokes my hair while I eat my rice between choking sobs. Bending down, Paul looks me in my eyes and says softly, "They lie. The soldiers lie. We cannot go home tonight." His words make me sob harder.
"But they said 3 days."
"I know. I'm sorry you believed them, but they lied."
"I don't understand why they lied."
My voice quivers as I say it.
"I don't know either, but they lied to us."
My hopes crushed, I wipe my forearm across my nose, dragging snot all over my cheek. Pa gently cleans my face with his hand, then takes the rice pot from me and says I only have to carry myself for the rest of the trip. With Gek on her hip, Ma walks over to me and wraps my scarf around my head to protect me from the sun. I wish that I were a little baby like Gek. She doesn't have to walk at all. Ma carries her in her arms all the way. I am miserable, but at least I have shoes. Some of the people walk barefoot in the scorching heat, carrying their life's belongings on their backs or heads. I feel sorry for them, knowing they are worse off than I am. And no matter how far we go, there are always more people along the way. When night falls, once again, we make the road our home and sleep, along with the hundreds of thousands of other families fleeing Phnom Penh. Our fourth day on the road starts the same as all the other days. "Are we there yet?" I keep asking Keem. When I receive no attention, I proceed to sniff and cry.
"Nobody cares about me,"
I moan, and keep walking anyway. By noontime, we have reached the Khmer Rouge's military checkpoint in the town of Kambul. The checkpoint consists of no more than a few small makeshift tents with trucks parked beside them. There are many soldiers at this base, and it is easy to recognize them because they wear identical, loose-fitting black pajama pants and shirts. All carry identical guns slung across their backs. They move quickly from place to place with fingers on the triggers of their weapons, pacing back and forth in front of the crowd, yelling instructions into a bullhorn.
"This is Kambul base. You are not allowed to pass until we have cleared you. Stand with your family in a line. Our comrade soldiers will come and ask a few simple questions. You are to answer them truthfully and not lie to the Angkar. If you lie to the Angkar, we will find out. The Angkar is all-knowing and has eyes and ears everywhere."
This is the first time I hear the word Angkar, which means the organization. Pa says the Angkor is the new government of Cambodia. He tells us that in the past, Prince Sihanouk ruled Cambodia as a monarch. Then, in 1970, unhappy with the prince's government, General Lon Nol deposed him in a military coup. The Lon Nol democratic government has been fighting a civil war with the communist Khmer Rouge ever since. Now the Khmer Rouge has won the war, and its government is called the Angkor.
To your right, you see a table where your comrade brothers sit waiting to help you. Anyone who has worked for the deposed government, ex-soldiers or politicians, step up to the table and register for work. The Angkor needs you right away.
Anxiety spreads through my body at the sight of the Khmer Rouge soldiers. I feel like I have to vomit. Pa quickly gathers our family and stands us in line with other peasant families.
Remember, we are a family of peasants. Give them whatever they want and don't argue. Don't say anything. Let me do all the talking. Don't go anywhere and don't make any moves unless I tell you to do so.
Pa instructs us firmly. Standing in line, wedged among many people, my nostrils are assaulted by the stale smell of bodies that have not been washed for many days. To filter the smell, I pull the scarf tightly over my nose and mouth. In front of us, the line splits in two as a large group of ex-soldiers, government workers, and former politicians walk over to the table to register for work. My heart pounds quickly against my chest, but I say nothing and lean against Pa's legs. He reaches down and puts his hand on top of my head. It stays there as if protecting me from the sun and the soldiers. After a few minutes, my head feels cooler and my heartbeat slows. Ahead of us in the line, Khmer Rouge soldiers yell something to the crowd, but I cannot hear what they say. Then one Khmer Rouge soldier roughly jerks a bag off of one man's shoulder and dumps its contents on the ground. From this pile, a Khmer Rouge soldier picks up an old Lon Nol army uniform. The Khmer Rouge soldier sneers at the man and pushes him to another Khmer Rouge soldier standing beside him. The soldier then moves on to the next family. Eyes downcast, shoulders slumped, arms hanging loosely on both sides of him, the man with the Lon Nol uniform in his bag does not fight as another Khmer Rouge soldier points and pushes him away with the butt of his rifle. After many hours, it is finally our time to be questioned. I can tell we've been standing here a long time because the sun now warms my lower back instead of the top of my head. As a Khmer Rouge soldier approaches us, my stomach twists into tight knots. I lean closer to Pa and reach up for his hand. Pa's hand is much too big for mine, so I am only able to wrap my fingers around his index finger.
"What do you do?" the soldier curtly asks Pa.
"I work as a packer in the shipping port."
"What do you do?"
The soldier points his finger at Ma. Her eyes focus on the ground, and she shifts Gek's weight on her hips.
"I sell old clothes in the market," she says in a barely audible voice.
The soldier rummages through all our bags one by one. Then he bends down and lifts the lid of the rice pot next to Pa's feet. Gripping Pa's finger even tighter, my heart races as the soldier checks the pot. His face is close to mine. I concentrate on my dirty toes. I dare not look into his eyes, for I have been told that when you look into their eyes, you can see the devil himself.
"All right, you are cleared. You may go."
"Thank you, comrade,"
Pa says meekly, his head bobbing up and down to the soldier. The soldier is already looking past Pa and merely waves his hand for us to hurry on. Passing the checkpoint safely, we walk a few hours more until the sun goes to sleep behind the mountains and the world becomes a place of shadows and shapes once again. In the mass of people, Pa finds us a spot of unoccupied grass near the side of the road. Ma puts Gek down next to me and tells me to keep an eye on her. Sitting next to her, I am struck by how pale she looks. Breathing quietly, she fights to keep her eyelids open, but in the end she loses and falls to sleep. Her growling stomach talks as mine grumbles in return. Knowing there will be nothing to eat for a while, I lie down on a small bundle of clothes next to her and rest my head on another. Quickly, I too fall asleep. When I wake, I am sitting upright on the straw mat, and Cave is pushing food into my mouth. "Eat this," she says. "Rice balls with wild mushrooms. Koi and Meng picked the mushrooms in the woods." With my eyes still closed, the rice ball works itself slowly down my dry throat and quiets my hunger. After I finish my small portion, I lie back down and leave the world of the Khmer Rouge soldiers behind. In the middle of the night, I dream I am at a New Year's parade. The Cambodian Lunar New Year this year falls on the 13th of April. Traditionally, for 3 days and nights, we celebrate the New Year with parades, food, and music. In my dream, fireworks crackle and boom noisily, rejoicing in the New Year celebration. There are many varieties of food on the table. Red cookies, red candies, red roasted pigs, and red noodles. Everything is red. I'm even wearing a new red dress that Ma has made for this special occasion. In the Chinese culture, it is not proper for girls to wear this color, because it attracts too much attention. Only girls who want attention wear red, and they are generally viewed as bad and improper, more than likely from a bad family. But New Year's is a special occasion, and during the celebration, everyone is allowed to wear red. Chu is next to me, clapping her hands at something. Gek is giggling and trying to catch up with me as I run and spin around and around. We all have on the same dress. We look so pretty with red ribbons in our ponytails, red rouge on our cheeks, and red lipstick on our lips. My sisters and I hold hands, laughing as fireworks boom in the background. I wake up the next morning to the voices of my brothers and father whispering to each other about what went on in the night. "Pa," Meng says in a frightened voice, "a man told me the noise last night was the Khmer Rouge soldiers opening fire on all the people who registered for work. They killed every one of them." Their words push at my temples, making my head throb with fear.
"Don't say anything. If the soldiers hear us, we will be in danger."
Hearing this makes me afraid, and I walk over to Pa. "We've been walking and walking for 5 days now. When can we go home?"
"Don't talk anymore,"
he whispers, and hands me over to Cave. Cave takes my hand and leads me to the woods so I can go to the bathroom. We have only taken a few steps when Koi stops us.
"Turn and walk back. Don't go any farther,"
he yells. She has to go.
"There's a dead body in the tall grass only a few feet from where you are. That's why this spot was left empty last night."
I grip Cave's hand tighter and suddenly notice the smell that hits my nostrils. It is not the smell of rotten grass or my own body odor, but a smell so putrid that my stomach coils. A smell similar to that of rotten chicken innards left out in the hot sun for too many days. Everything surrounding me becomes blurry, and I do not hear Cave telling me to move my legs. I hear only the buzzing of flies feasting on the human corpse. I feel Cave's hand pull at me, and my feet automatically move in her direction. With my hand in hers, we catch up with the rest of the family and begin our 6th day of marching. On our walk, the soldiers are everywhere, prodding us along. They point and give us directions with their guns and bullhorns. In the scorching April heat, many older people become ill from heatstroke and dehydration, but they dare not rest. When someone falls ill, the family throws out his belongings, puts the sick person on someone's back or a wagon if the family is lucky enough to have one, and march on. We walk all through the morning and afternoon, stopping for food and to rest only when the sun goes down. All around us, other families also have stopped to rest for the night. Some stagger into the field, picking up firewood to cook their meals. Others eat what they cooked earlier and fall asleep as soon as they lie down. We walk around the curled-up bodies to find an empty area of our own. Exhausted, Ma and Cave struggle to set up our resting spot and start a fire. From one of the plastic bags we carry our remaining belongings in, Cave takes out a bedsheet and spreads it on the ground. Ma unrolls the straw mat and lines it up next to the bedsheets, while I sit with Gek on small bundles, rubbing my burned and aching ankles. Chu and Kim move our other bags onto the bedsheet. Holding her hand, I attempt to lead Gek to sit on the sheets, but she pulls out of my hand and toddles over to Pa. He picks her up and holds her to his chest. Her face, brown and blistered from the sun, rests at the nape of his neck as his body swivels left and right. Before long, she is asleep. Our food supply is reduced to only a few pounds of rice, so Meng, Khoi, and Kim have to forage for other food to supplement the rice. They walk half a mile to the nearby town of Ong Snur and return an hour later. Their figures move toward us slowly. Kim carries an armful of dry wood, and in Meng's hand is a small branch piercing two small fish and some wild vegetables. Khoi walks toward us with a small pot and an ecstatic grin on his face. "Ma, look," he calls to her, barely able to contain his glee.
"Sugar."
"Brown sugar," Ma exclaims, taking the pot away from him. Though I am tired, these two words bring me running in the direction of the pot.
"Brown sugar," I repeat quietly.
I never knew how two little words could bring me so much happiness. "Ma, let me have a taste. There's almost a quarter of a pot of it."
"Shh, don't say it so loud," Cave warns me, "or people will come and beg us for some."
I notice a few of our neighbors look in our direction.
"Here, everyone, have a small taste. We have to save some," Ma says as we gather around her.
My siblings stick their fingers into the sugar and lick what they are able to pull out.
"Me, me, me,"
I beg Ma as she slowly lowers the pot to my level. I know it is my one chance to get as much sugar as I can, so I wait a few seconds to form enough spit in my mouth. Then I put my finger in my mouth and swish the spit around my finger to make sure I wet every millimeter of my finger. When I am satisfied that my finger is wet enough, I take it out of my mouth and slowly roll it around on top of the sugar. My finger rolls so slowly that I can feel the rough grains bonding to it. When I pull it out of the pot, I am happy to see what I have achieved. I have more sugar on my one finger than anyone else does. Carefully, I place my other hand under my treasure to catch any grains that might fall from my finger. Slowly, I walk my finger back to my spot on the mat and begin to eat each grain of the sugar. After dinner, Ma takes us girls to a nearby pond, which is already crowded with people washing their clothes and naked children tentatively putting their heads under the muddy water. The children all look too tired to bop up and down, laugh, or splash at one another. Ma instructs us to strip off our clothes. I remove my brown shirt, a shirt that was yellow when I hurriedly dressed 6 days ago. Naked, Chu, Gek, and I wait while Ma removes her clothes from under her sarong and hands them over to Cave. With no soap, Cave takes the clothes to the edge of the river and scrubs them against the rocks to get them clean. With Gek balanced on one of her hips, Ma takes my hand and walks Chu and I into the pond for our first wash in 6 days. Hand in hand, we stop when the water reaches my waist. The water feels cool and soft on my skin, slowly peeling away the layers of grime that have collected. The slippery grass in the water sways back and forth to the rhythm of our movements, gently brushing against my legs. Some of the blades slither around my ankles, sending chills up and down my spine. I jump and fall into the water, pulling Chu with me, who is still holding on tight to Ma's hand. When I resurface, they are all laughing at me. I am happy to have all of us laughing together again. In the morning, Ma wakes everyone, and we get ready for our 7th day of walking. The road ahead of us shimmers in the heat, and the dust swells are everywhere, burning my eyes. In the distance, my eyes focus on a lone bicyclist. I cannot tell how tall he is, only that he is very thin. It is strange that he is traveling against the flow of traffic. All of a sudden, I am startled by Ma's scream. Between loud, halting sobs, Ma manages to say, "It's your Uncle Zhang!" With our hands in the air and bodies jumping up and down, we wave excitedly to our uncle.
Uncle Hyang waves one hand back and pedals his bike faster in our direction. He comes to a stop a few feet from us, and all at once we rush toward him. Blinking his eyes, he takes Ma into his arms with Pa standing quietly beside them. All the worries and fears of the past few days are now over, for at last he has found his sister. Uncle Hyang hands Ma a package from his front bike rack, and while she opens the cans of tuna and other food, he tells Pa that this morning other people from Phnom Penh arrived in his village. The new arrivals told of the evacuation and how the Khmer Rouge forced everyone to leave all the cities, including Phnom Penh, Battambang, and Siem Reap. Hearing this, he got on his bike and has been looking for us all morning. He then shares with us the glorious news that Ma's oldest brother Hyang is on his way to pick us up in a wagon. A smile of joy crosses over my face, knowing I will not have to walk anymore, and that in a few days we can ride in their wagon home. Standing next to Uncle Hyang, I have to tilt my head back as far as I can to see his face because he is so tall. Even then, all I can see is the shape of his thin lips and wide black nostrils that flare once every few seconds as he talks to Ma. At almost 6 feet tall, second Uncle Kim Yang hovers above all of us. His long, thin arms and legs make him look like the stick figures I used to draw in my school books. Uncle Hyang lives in a village called Krang Truop. Both Uncle Hyang and Uncle Hyang have lived in the countryside since before the revolution and have never lived in a city. The Khmer Rouge considers them uncorrupted model citizens for their new society. Pa says we will go and live with our uncles in their village. The wagon, pulled by two yellow, skinny cows moving very slowly, arrives later that evening. While Pa and Ma talk to my uncle, I quickly claim a seat in the wagon with Chu and Gek. Our trail takes us on a gravel road along Route 26 westward until we reach the Khmer Rouge-occupied village of Bat Deng. No matter where we go or in which direction we turn, there are people marching ahead and behind us. In the midst of the crowd, our wagon passes the Khmer Rouge village without stopping. We veer westward, leaving our roadside companions far behind. Somewhere between Bat Deng and Krang Truop, I fall asleep. Krang Truop, April 1975. On the morning of April 25th, 8 days after leaving our wonderful home in Phnom Penh, we arrive at our destination. Krang Truop is a small and dusty village, surrounded by rice fields as far as the eye can see. All around the rice paddies, little red dirt roads wind like snakes slithering through water. In the fields, gray buffaloes and brown cows graze lazily on the grass. Many have bells tied on strings around their necks, which chime when the animals slowly move their heads. When they run, they remind me of the sound of the ice cream cart in Phnom Penh. Here, instead of concrete city buildings and houses, people live in huts made out of straw that squat on four stilts above elephant grass in the middle of rice paddies. "The kids are even messier than I am," I exclaim, as one runs across our path, oblivious to my own ragtag appearance. "Ma's always complaining about me. Just look at them." The children are red and dusty all over, crimson earth clinging to their clothing, skin, and hair. Chu frowns at me and shakes her head. Though she is only 3 years older than I am, Chu often acts as if she knows many more things than I do. I have the larger build and can beat her up easily, though I rarely do it. Because she is shy, quiet, obedient, and doesn't say much, all our older siblings assume what she chooses to say is of some importance and usually take her side in our fights. Because I am loud and talkative, my words are thought trite and silly. Chu looks at me now with her brows wrinkling close together, as if trying to figure out my thoughts. I stick my tongue out at her. "I don't care. I am thrilled to be here and able to return home in a few days." After a joyous reunion with my aunts and many cousins, Pa disappears with Uncle Hyang to meet with the village chief and request permission to live here. Uncle Hyang and Uncle Hyang say that since the Khmer Rouge have won the war, The soldiers removed the old village chief and replaced him with a Khmer Rouge cadre. Now the villagers have to seek permission for the simplest of human desires, to have family members live with them or to leave the village to visit another area. They return shortly and report that our request is granted. My interest in the town quickly dies when Pa tells us we will all live with Uncle Liang and his family in their house. Uncle Liang and his wife have 6 children, so with the 9 of us, it makes 17 under one thatched roof. Their house would not be called a house by city people's standards. It looks more like one of those simple huts poor people live in. The roof and walls are made of straw, and the hut has only a dirt floor. There are no bedrooms or bathrooms, just one big open room. There is no indoor kitchen, so all the cooking is done outside under a straw roof awning. Later that night, Keem took me aside, scolding me for being snobbish about our new house. Even as a 10-year-old boy, he understood how brave our uncle was to beg the new Khmer Rouge village chief to permit us to stay. "The village is so poor," I say to Pa, as the family gathers on the floor of Uncle Liang's hut. Sitting on straw mats or wooden stools and chairs, we listen to Pa's instructions.
"So are we."
The sternness in Pa's voice makes my face burn with shame.
"From now on, we are as poor as all these people here. We have to live far away from the city, where people might recognize me and know who I am. If anybody outside the family asks where we are from, tell them we are country people, just like your uncles."
"Why don't we want them to know who we are, Pa? Why can't we go home to our own house? The soldiers promised that we could go home after 3 days."
"The Khmer Rouge lied. They have won the war, and we cannot go back. You must stop thinking we can go back. You have to forget Phnom Penh."
Pa has never spoken so bluntly to me before, and slowly, the reality of what he says sinks in. My body trembles with fear and disbelief. I am never going home. I will never see Phnom Penh again, drive in our car, ride a siklo with Ma to the markets, buy food from the carts. All of that is gone. He reaches out and takes me into his arms, as my eyes water and my lips tremble. As Pa continues to talk, I slide out of his arms and into caves. Pa tries to make my brothers understand the history of politics in Cambodia. Led by Prince Sihanouk, Cambodia, then a French colony, became an independent nation in 1953. Throughout the 1950s and 1960s, Cambodia prospered and was self-sufficient. However, many people were not happy with Prince Sihanouk's government. Many regarded the Sihanouk government as corrupt and self-serving, where the poor got poorer and the rich became richer. Various nationalistic factions sprang up to demand reforms. One of the groups, a secret communist faction, the Khmer Rouge, launched an armed struggle against the Cambodian government. The war in Vietnam spread to Cambodia when the United States bombed Cambodia's borders to try to destroy the North Vietnamese bases. The bombings destroyed many villages and killed many people, allowing the Khmer Rouge to gain support from the peasants and farmers. In 1970, Prince Sihanouk was overthrown by his top general, Lon Nol. The United States-backed Lon Nol government was corrupt and weak and was easily defeated by the Khmer Rouge. Pa says many more things to my brothers, but I don't care much about politics. All I know is that I am supposed to act dumb and never speak of our lives in the city. I can never tell another soul that I miss home, that I want to go back to the way things were. I rest my head on Cave's shoulder and close my eyes while gritting my teeth. She softly strokes my hair and caresses my cheeks.
"Don't worry. Your big sister will look after you," she whispers quietly into my hair.
Next to her, Ma sits on the mat, holding Gek, who sleeps quietly in her arms. Chu is next to her, focusing on her red and white chroma, intently folding and refolding it. Later in the night, lying on the wooden plank for beds, I keep Chu awake by tossing and turning.
I hate this. I am so uncomfortable,
I gripe to Chu, who is sleeping next to me. In the city, we three youngest girls slept on mattresses in the same bed. On the farm, the boys get to sleep in hammocks, while the girls sleep all lined up like sardines on a rough wooden platform made of bamboo trees. I'd much rather sleep in the hammocks.
Be quiet and go to sleep. Chu, I have to go to the bathroom.
Go, then.
I'm afraid. Come with me.
Chu answers by turning her back to me. Every time I have to go, I have to walk into the woods by myself to the outhouse. We have used up our paper money and now have nothing to use for toilet paper. Chu taught me to use leaves, but at night, when I cannot see, I am afraid there might be bugs on them. Entering the woods at night is a haunting experience, especially for someone with a vivid imagination. In the darkness, I see spirits shaking the trees, letting me know they are waiting for me. They whisper chants and spells that the wind carries through the leaves back to my ears. The spirits call me to come to them so they can take possession of my body. I am so filled with fear about going to the bathroom alone at night that I force myself to hold it until dawn when I make a mad run into the woods. I soon realize how early everyone gets up when they are already busy about the farm before the sun rises and long before I awake the next morning. Life on the farm is boring and dull, but at least there is enough to eat. Unlike my life in Phnom Penh, I do not have any friends outside the family. It is hard to make friends because I am afraid to speak, afraid I will blurt out secrets about our family. Pa says the Angkor has abolished markets, schools, and universities, and has banned money, watches, clocks, 8-track players, and televisions. Since we are now a family of peasants, I will have to learn the time of day and night by the position of the sun and moon in the sky. If I run into other children and speak to them, I have to watch what I say and what language I use. I cannot mention the food I wish I could eat, the movies I have seen, or the siklo I have ridden in. If I speak about them, the children will know we are from the city. I am used to kids seeking my attention and friendship in the city. Here they look at me with suspicion and steer away from me when I approach them. No matter, I have many cousins to play with. On the days I don't spend watching other people watch us, I help my older cousins bring their cows to the field to graze. I gradually adjust to life on the farm and let go of my dream of returning home. The first time my cousin Li Chun puts me on a cow, I am afraid I will fall off. The cows are much taller than I am. Li Chun is 16 and taller than the cows. She hoists me effortlessly on top of one. Sitting on its back, my legs hang to the middle of its stomach. My hands hold tightly to the rope tied to the ring pierced through its nose, while my legs hug its body. Every time the cow moves, its huge ribcage shifts between my legs, and my heels slide over the ribs like fingers over piano keys. "Relax your body," Li Chun laughs. "Cows are lazy, so they move slowly. You will fall if you sit so rigidly." Following her advice, I stop holding on so hard and sway my upper body with the movement of the cow. After a few minutes, my fear subsides. "How much farther before we stop? It's hot and my bottom is hurting," I complain. "We're going just over the hill where the grass is greener. You're the one who wants to come, so stop grumbling." Li Chun points to a group of girls walking in a distant field. "Look. At least you don't have their jobs." They are peasant girls, not much older than I am, wandering in the field. They carry bags strapped diagonally across their back, and their eyes look at the ground. Occasionally, a girl bends to pick up a round, greenish-black patty from the ground and puts it in her bag.
"What are they doing?"
"They are collecting dry cow dung."
"Disgusting!"
Usually, the peasants come by with their wagons and scoop up the fresh manure to use as topsoil. These girls are picking up the dry manure because it is believed to have medicinal properties. They will boil it in water and drink it like tea.
"Disgusting!" I exclaim again.
Even the new experience of riding on a cow becomes dull when you do it every day. Yet despite the monotony of farm life, the longer we live in Krang Truop, the more fearful and anxious I become. Everywhere I venture, I cannot shake the feeling that someone is watching, following me. Though I have nowhere to go, each morning I hurriedly dress myself so I can catch a glimpse of Pa before he goes off to work. On most days, by the time I am awake, Pa and my brothers are already gone, and Ma is busy sewing clothes for the family or working in the garden. After getting dressed, I do what I can to keep up my hygiene. Pa tells us it is important, so I try to make him happy. Since we no longer have toothbrushes or toothpaste, I use a handful of hay and run it over my teeth like a brush. To get to the back teeth, I have to reach into my mouth with my fingernails and scrape away the thick yellow crust. To wash, I use a bath stall, similar to an outhouse. Inside, there is a big round container that looks like a 3-foot-tall clay flower pot, which Keem and the other cousins fill with water every evening. I undress and hang my clothes on a splinter of wood on the door. Then I reach into the container and take a bowl full of water and pour it over myself. There is no soap or shampoo, and as a result, my hair becomes very sticky and knotted, and it is painful to comb. Pa returns late at night, looking dirty and tired. Sometimes, after a quick meal, Pa sits quietly outside by himself and stares at the sky. When he comes back into the hut, he falls quickly asleep. I hardly ever sit on his lap anymore. I miss his hugs and how he used to make me laugh at old Chinese stories. Pa's tales were often about the Buddhist gods and their dragons coming down to earth to fight evil and protect people. I wonder if the gods and dragons will come help us now. Waiting Station, July 1975.
"What's going on?" I ask Ma, rubbing my eyes. "Why did you wake me up?"
I open my eyes to see the sky is still dark, but that Uncle Hyang, his wife Aunt Kyung, and all the cousins are up. Beside me, Chu rolls up her thin blanket, folds her clothes, and puts them in her pillowcase. Outside, Lee Chun scoops ladles full of cooked rice and puts it on banana leaves. Cave pokes the crackling fire to cook the dried fish while Keem fills up the petrol container with water.
"Quiet, we have to go."
Ma puts her hand over my mouth.
"I don't want to go. I don't want to walk again."
"I want to go back to sleep. Though we have been living at Krang Truop for 2 months and my blistered feet have healed, the thought of more walking makes my ankles throb with pain."
"Quiet," Pa admonishes me.
"We don't want anyone to hear you crying. It is not safe for us to stay here anymore. We have to go, and we will ride on a truck to get there."
"Why do we have to go, Pa?"
"It is no longer safe for us to stay here."
"Are we walking a long way?"
"No. Your uncles talked the chief into arranging for us to be picked up by a Khmer Rouge truck. The truck will take us to Battambang. That is where your grandmother lives."
"But I do not want to move any more, Pa."
Pa has no words to soothe me. Biting back my tears, I put on my flip-flops and walk toward Cave's extended hand. Pa and Ma turn to Uncle Hyang and thank him for letting us stay with him. Uncle Hyang looks at her, face hanging, eyes blinking rapidly, and blesses Ma for a safe journey. The cousins stand outside the hut to see us off. Their hands dangle lifelessly by their sides as they watch Pa lead us away. By the time we arrive at the rendezvous area on the roadside, about 30 people have already gathered there. They squat and sit on the gravel road in 4 family groups. Many have almond-shaped eyes, thin noses, and light skin, which suggests they might also be of Chinese descent. Pure Khmer have curly black hair, flat noses, full lips, and dark chocolate skin. Our fellow travelers do not acknowledge our presence. Instead, they stare passively at the road. Like us, they carry with them light bundles of clothes and small packages of food. We sit on the gravel road next to them, but no words are exchanged. In the dark of night, We all wait for the truck. The world around us remains tranquil and asleep. All that can be heard is the chirping of crickets. The moments feel like forever. Then, suddenly, the glaring headlights of the military truck appear, and it stops before us. Pa transfers me from his warm arms onto the hard, cold bed of the truck. I do not want to let go of him. I do not want to ever leave his safe arms. The ride is bumpy and loud, but the cool dawn air keeps us reasonably comfortable. Ma stares off into the distance while Gek sleeps in her arms. My other siblings are half-dozing, half-awake, while I find safety in Pa's arms again. Everyone is very quiet as the truck drives on. All morning the truck heads northwest as the sun climbs higher and higher in the sky, and the wind blows away what little protection the clouds have to offer. The truck driver does not have Pa's driving skills, nor does he care whether those of us in the back bounce and bump into one another. The truck drives all day and stops only in the evening for us to cook our food. As soon as it stops, everyone jumps off to stretch their weary bodies. Pa lifts me out of the truck and puts me on the ground next to Chu. All around us, people are shaking their legs crazily, as if trying to get rid of animals that have crawled up their pant legs. Koi walks in a circle, swinging his arms very quickly from side to side. He is a martial artist with a black belt in karate. At 5 feet 7 inches, Koi is slender and fit. In Phnom Penh, I loved to sit and watch him practice karate. It amazed me that he could kick one leg up above his head and hold the stance for a long time. He could jump high in the air, do many fast kicks, and land safely on his feet, all in a few seconds, while screaming funny sounds and contorting his face. It always made me laugh. Now he walks around faster and faster in a circle, and his arms are like propellers, about to carry him off like a helicopter. He is doing the same movements I've seen him do so many times before, but this time his face is not funny, and I am not laughing. After our short rest and meal, we get back on the truck and remain there all through the night. I wake up in Pa's lap in the morning to see that we have arrived at a truck stop. There are people everywhere. Some are cooking breakfast, others are just waking up, and many are still asleep on the side of the road or in the grass. Sitting in the back of the truck, we dare not move until the soldiers instruct us to.
"We are in Pursat province. You are to wait here until the base people come to take you to live in their village,"
a soldier tells us and walks away. "Why did we have to leave last night?" I ask Pa.
"Some of the new arrivals in Krang Truop are from Phnom Penh. Even though they are friends, it is dangerous to live there because they know who I am."
"Pa, they're our friends. They wouldn't tell on us and get us in trouble."
"Friendship does not matter. They may not have a choice."
Pa is very solemn as he speaks to me. I do not understand what he means, but decide not to pursue this line of questioning. "Are we going to Battambang on these trucks?" I ask quietly.
"No, this is not the route to Battambang. The soldiers have taken us to a different place."
"Can't we tell them we have to go to Battambang, that they have taken us to the wrong place?"
"No, we cannot argue with them. We will go wherever they choose to take us."
Pa sounds fatigued as he puts me on the ground. He tells Keem to look after me while he tries to find out when we will be leaving. As he walks away into the crowd of people, I watch until his figure disappears. Keem tells me that from now on I have to watch out for myself. Not only am I never to talk to anyone about our former lives, but I'm never to trust anyone either. It is best if I just stop talking completely, so I won't unintentionally disclose information about our family. To talk is to bring danger to the family. At 5 years old, I am beginning to know what loneliness feels like, silent and alone, and suspecting that everyone wants to hurt me. "I am going to look around," I tell Keem, bored. "Don't go far and don't talk to anyone. We might have to leave very soon, and I don't want to have to go looking for you." I want to obey my brother's warnings not to go far, but I'm curious. When my family is looking elsewhere, I sneak away from under their watchful eyes to explore the waiting station. The farther I walk, the more I see of the hundreds of people at the camp. They talk, sit, or sleep anywhere they can. Many tents have wet clothes hanging all over their lines, piles of wood by the crackling fire, and homemade wooden benches. Looking as if they have been waiting for a long time, some lie so motionless, I wonder if they are alive. I stop to look at one old woman. Dressed in a brown shirt and maroon sarong, she lies on the ground with her arms at her side and her head propped up by a small bundle. Her eyes are half-closed, white hair strewn in all directions, and skin yellow and wrinkled. The young woman next to her spoon-feeds the old woman rice gruel. "She looks dead to me," I say to the young woman. "What's wrong with her?" "Gram's half-dead, can't you tell?" she says to me in annoyance. The longer I stare at her, the more my skin sweats. I have never seen anyone who is half-dead before. Ignoring me, the young woman continues to feed her grandmother. One side of her mouth swallows the rice gruel, while the other side drools and spits the food back out. I never thought this was possible. I just thought you were either completely dead or alive. I feel sorry for the old woman, but am fascinated at the prospect of being caught between the two worlds. My fascination overrides my fear of her. "Are there any doctors or anyone who can help her?" "There are no doctors anywhere. Go away! Aren't your parents looking for you?" She is right, of course. I hear Ma calling my name and beckoning me to return. Luckily, my family is too busy boarding yet another truck to be angry with me. As Pa lifts me onto the truck, I notice two very thin, middle-aged men in loose-fitting black pajama pants and shirts standing next to us. While one writes something on small brown pads of paper with his black pen, the other points at our heads and counts as we climb onto the truck. I find myself a seat where I can watch the countryside. Quickly, four other families clamber onto the truck and fill up the empty space in the middle. Once all the families are on board, the two men take their notes and count again, without smiling or greeting us. After they are finished, they get into the front seats with the truck driver, and we begin to move. The truck rolls away from the waiting area and onto a bumpy, narrow road crossing the mountains. The families are quiet and somber. The only sounds come from the branches brushing against the side of the truck and the slush of mud sticking to the tires. After what seems like forever, I become bored with the scenery and climb onto Pa's lap. "Pa," I say quietly, so the others cannot hear us, "the people at the place we just left, why were they there?"
"They are waiting for the base people to come and take them."
"Take them like they've taken us?"
"Yes. The men wearing black clothes are representatives from rural villages. At the waiting area, these representatives are given a list of names and people they are to take back to their villages," Pa says quietly.
"Those two men, are they our village representatives?"
"Yes."
"Who are the base people?"
"Shh. I will tell you later."
"How come we left there so fast while all the others waited?"
"I bribed someone with one of your Ma's gold necklaces to put our names on a list so we could leave."
Pa lets out a sigh and is once again quiet. I rest my head on his chest and think how lucky I am to have such a father. I know Pa loves me. Back in Phnom Penh, in the movie theater, I would always demand the seat next to Pa. When a movie got scary, I would grab onto his arm, signaling to him that I was ready to hop on his lap. Pa would then lift me from my chair and plop me on his lap so that his body became my chair, his arms my armrest. It seems so long ago now. He seems so serious and sad. And I wonder if I will ever see my fun paw again.
Ong Long Moor,
July 1975. I wake up to find that we have stopped, and all the families are getting off the truck. The village representatives have a few words with the truck driver before he drives away, leaving us in the middle of nowhere.
All around us, green mountain peaks jut into the gray sky. July is the midpoint of the rainy season. The air, though cool, is heavy and humid. Thick, tall trees with wide green leaves and fat elephant grass surround us. I sit next to Chu and Gek on our small pile of clothes, listening to the sound of shrieking birds while the others stretch their bodies. A few feet away, Pa and the fathers of the four other families who came with us on the truck listen to the representatives as they give out instructions.
"We have to walk from here, up to the mountains," Pa tells us.
Pa picks up Gek and carries her on his back. Koi, Meng, Cave, and Kim gather up our bundles of clothes and follow the representatives as they lead us to a small, hidden trail up the mountain. Chu and I hold Ma's hand and trail behind the other families. I try to run to be up near Pa in case there are snakes or wild animals who eat young children in the mountains, but pebbles and rocks slow me down by getting in my flip-flops, forcing me to shake them out every few minutes. We hike up the narrow path in silence. By nightfall, we arrive at our destination. The village chief takes all five families to his house and gives us rice and fish for dinner before the adults leave to hear further instructions. Afterward, he leads us to a little hut behind his house that is to be our new home. The hut sits on four wooden legs raised 3 feet off the ground. Its roof and walls are covered with bamboo leaves and straw.
"This village is called On Long Moor, and we will live here for the time being," Pa informs us that night. "Depending on when the truck arrives with the supplies, every week or two the chief will ration each family salt, rice, and grains. To supplement these rations, we will grow a vegetable garden in the back of the hut. Remember, do not talk about Phnom Penh. There are Khmer Rouge soldiers patrolling the village, reporting our activities to the Angkor. From now on, we are country folk, just like everybody else."
Our whole family sleeps together, lined up like sardines under a big mosquito net in the house. We huddle together to keep warm. On the second night, I become sick and have a terrible fever. My body aches all over and I throw up a lot. I feel hot and cold. I cannot sleep and have no appetite. Ma wraps me up in many layers of blankets, but still I cannot get warm. When I am very hot, I see ghosts and monsters coming to kill me. My heart races, causing searing pains to shoot up my spine and burn my flesh. I am scared of the monsters and run to get away, but no matter how fast or how far I run, I can never escape them. When I come to, Ma tells me that Kim and Chu were also sick and had the same nightmares of being tracked down and killed by monsters.
"It's the mountains and the weather," Pa tells us. "We will get used to it eventually. We have to watch what we eat. There are no doctors or medicines here, only homemade remedies."
Pa should tell the mosquitoes to watch what they eat, for they are the wicked things that make us sick. We are not the only new people here. Koi tells us that of the 800 people at Ong Long Moor, approximately 300 are new arrivals. But the village population changes every day because the Angkor constantly moves people in and out of the village, which is how we ended up in an empty house. Every day, Pa, Koi, and Meng wake with the sun to work, and when the sun sets, come home. They work very hard, some days planting rice and vegetables and cutting lumber, and other days building dams and digging trenches. No matter how hard they work, after the first month, there is less and less food to eat. We survive on the fish my brothers catch each day. We can no longer afford to eat plain rice, but have to mix it with mushrooms, banana stalks, and other leaves. After a few weeks, even the leaves are becoming scarce. Ma tells us only to pick the old dark green leaves and not the light green ones in our garden. She says that we need the light green leaves to grow, thus giving us more food. When we catch animals, we eat everything. Feet, tongue, skin, and the innards. One day, Keen comes home grinning from ear to ear because he has caught a small wild bird. Ma smiles widely and pats Keen's head before taking the bird from him. Keen has tied its legs together, but it struggles and tries to peck at Ma's hand. "Go fetch a bowl and a knife quickly," Ma tells Chu. She takes the bird's wings and crosses them against each other on its back. With its wings secure, Ma instructs Chu to place the bowl under the bird, Holding its body between her knees, Ma takes its head and bends it backward, stretching its neck. As if sensing danger, the bird croaks louder and struggles to get away, but to no avail. Ma's free hand picks up a knife, and in one swift moment, the sharp edge slices into the bird's neck, silencing it. Thick blood spews out from the bird's open gash and drips into the bowl. "Catch it all," Ma says anxiously to Chu. "It's good blood." Chu picks up the bowl and brings it close to the wound to catch all the blood.
"Put it in a cool place, in the shade, so it will congeal faster. We can make rice soup with it."
"Tonight we will have a good dinner," Ma announces, smiling and finally letting go of the bird. Though dead and drained of blood, its body shakes violently in the dirt. "Poor bird," I whimper, reaching over to softly pet its feathers. Its blood stains my hands, but I continue to pet it until its trembling body becomes completely still. Eventually, food becomes so scarce that the village chief sends Meng, Koi, and the other young men to the top of the mountain to dig for wild potatoes, bamboo shoots, and roots to feed the village. Each week they leave on Monday and return exhausted on Wednesday or Thursday. On a good week, they come home with many bags of food, and the chief rations it out to all the other villagers. There are times when they return with very little, and each person is given only one small potato per day. It is our second month in An Long Moor, and we are amid one of the worst rainfalls ever. It starts every morning and rains throughout the day, stopping briefly only late at night. It rains so hard that my brothers are not able to go up the mountain to dig for potatoes and bamboo. What food we had planted in the garden has been washed away by the rain. To survive, my older siblings shake the trees at night, hoping to find June bugs. The younger kids, because we are closer to the ground, catch frogs and grasshoppers for food. The rain makes the ground soft and muddy. Chu, Keem, and I often slide around in the mud, even when we're not looking for frogs. With brown mud covering our faces, hair, and clothes, we laugh and roll in the sludge like pigs. Within minutes, the rain pours over us, washing away the dirt and mud. We pull the wings and heads off the bugs we catch and roast them with salt and pepper. Weeks go by, and still it rains. The rain floods the village and the water rises to Pa's waist, drowning many animals. Pa tells us the flood is why all huts are built on stilts, high off the ground. Cold and hungry, the only food we have to eat are the fish and rabbits that float by. Pa ties a fish net to a long stick to catch them as they pass by in the rushing water beside our hut.
"Pa! Pa! Here comes something!" I scream excitedly one day.
"That's a good one. It looks like a rabbit."
"Look, Pa, here comes another," Chu tells him. Pa extends his hand to catch them with his net. He reaches in and pulls out two rabbits by the heads. The size of big rats, they hang limp and lifeless in his hands, their fur matted to their bodies. He takes the rabbits and places them on a wooden board. Their necks make a small crunching sound as he chops off their heads with his little knife. Keem then pours a bowl of water on the corpses to wash away the blood. Pa cuts open the skin from the neck all the way down to the bottom of the stomach. With that, he grabs the skin from the neck and pulls it off the bodies. Pa then separates the meat from the bones and cuts the flesh into very thin slices to soak in the lime juice that Ma has prepared. Because everything is wet and there's a foot of water underneath us, we cannot make a fire. Pa feeds us young children slices of the rabbit meat. Though the lime juice cuts the taste a little, I still hate the texture of it. The flesh stretches and pulls in my mouth, and it's hard to chew. My stomach tightens, wanting to throw the food back out. Sucking on a slice of lime, I force the meat to stay down, because I know that there is no more food for me if I spit it out. Eventually, the rainy season is over, and the flood recedes, leaving behind wet, muddy ground. The whole village is in a state of panic, for there is no food anywhere.